People who live in some low-income or minority communities get more input if, say, an industrial plant moves into their community.
Absolutely. I would like to choose what was going in my backyard.
But when it comes to fracking, they don't have as much power. I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we look at a loophole in Pennsylvania's environmental justice program. Plus, we dig into the health benefits of gardening.
We play in dirt, and we teach children how to play in dirt, and then we teach adults how to play in dirt. It's not going to kill you. You could always wash your hands.
And the Ohio River has always been seen as a working river, even by the people who live along it. But that could change.
Outdoor recreation, art, food diversity, cultural diversity, those are the things that will be the identifying factors going forward in these communities.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The concept of environmental justice is that the costs of industrial development shouldn't disproportionately burden poor or largely minority communities. Pennsylvania's environmental justice program was started more than a decade ago to give these communities more of a voice when things like oil refineries or landfills are built nearby. But the policy was written before the state's fracking boom began, so none of the state's more than 10,000 shale gas wells were ever subject to it. For our Hazardous to Your Health series, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports some environmentalists think it's time that changes.
For Kirk Jalbert, the moment he started thinking about fracking and environmental justice was about a year and a half ago. That's when a gas company executive made an offhand remark at a legal conference that his company didn't frack in rich neighborhoods where residents could afford expensive lawsuits to fight the industry.
And, you know, within the way that we understand environmental justice, that will be, you know, an egregious admission of trying to skirt environmental justice rules.
The executive later called the comment a joke. But that got Jalbert thinking. Was this joke actually true? So Jalbert, an environmental data scientist who works with a nonprofit group, Frack Tracker Alliance, mapped wells in three western Pennsylvania counties. Out of nearly 800 wells, only two were drilled in places with median home values over $200,000. He found similar data on gas leases. Jalbert says there's a pattern here, but he doesn't know exactly why wealthier neighborhoods are less likely to have gas activity.
Is it because people have the means to not necessarily need to lease their properties for profit? They have other streams of income? Or is it because they want to maintain an aesthetic that people in poorer communities don't have the luxury to maintain?
But Jalbert also found that only 5% of shale gas wells in the state were in places designated as environmental justice areas. Pennsylvania defines these as places with either 30% minority population or where 20% of the population live under the federal poverty line. Jalbert says people in many gas areas may not be officially poor, but they're not that far from it.
You're not seeing necessarily deep poverty, but you see what I call working poor and what other people call working poor, which is just above the poverty threshold.
The state's environmental justice policies were drawn up after residents in a largely black community near Philadelphia sued the state, which had allowed companies to build several toxic and hazardous waste facilities nearby. Once a community is designated as an environmental justice area, people get more say when it comes to developments that could impact them. Under the state's policy, facilities like landfills and power plants must provide extra opportunities for public participation. These include sending out more public notices and holding extra hearings. The intent is to give people who might not be able to afford a lawyer or take off from work to attend public hearings more opportunities to comment on a project.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would like to choose what was going in my backyard.
Kim Gifford lives in Dunkard, Greene County, near the West Virginia border. The town is in an environmental justice area. Gifford says she'd be in favor of adding oil and gas to the program. She lives less than a mile from the nearest shale gas well and is close to dozens more. But she also benefits from the gas industry. Gifford's husband is an ironworker who's working at Shell's ethane cracker in Beaver County, which will use the gas that's pumped from wells locally. Still, she would like to have some say in how the industry operates in her neighborhood.
I'm all for that. I think they should, especially so close to, you know, small towns. You got to worry about your water, your air.
In 2015, former DEP Secretary John Quigley said he would make sure the agency would include oil and gas in the environmental justice program. He said that it was justified because of concerns that increases in shale gas drilling could contribute to air and water pollution.
There's obviously a significant level of concern about the potential to harm public health, especially. And very frankly, I think it comported with the not only the definition of environmental justice that was operating at the time, but certainly where I thought the agency needed to go.
But the state hasn't gone there yet with oil and gas. Quigley was let go by the Wolf administration before he could enact changes to the environmental justice program. Quigley's predecessor at the DEP, Mike Crancer, declined a request for a recorded interview. But in an email, Crancer said he thought there were reasons drilling permits, quote, do not fit the original intent of environmental justice review. Crancer, who now works for a Philadelphia law firm that represents energy companies, said the program was designed to prevent companies from intentionally siting polluting facilities in poor or minority neighborhoods. With oil and gas, he said, companies don't have a choice of where to site a well. They have to put it where the resource is. The natural gas industry says the additional scrutiny would only hurt areas in need of money. The Marcellus Shale Coalition, in an email, said there was no need or justification to add gas wells to the environmental justice program. It says it would slow down what it calls an already slow process. By law, the DEP is required to issue permit decisions on gas wells within 45 days. But the current wait time, according to the industry group, is over 90 days. A few miles away from Dunkard, in the town of Mount Morris, Lori Haynes says she agrees with the gas industry. Mount Morris is not in an environmental justice area, but Haynes, who works as a teacher in nearby West Virginia, says she's seen families that were struggling, helped by the money they got from leasing their land to gas companies.
If we cripple what could be income for an area in an area that really needs income, I'm not so sure who that's helping.
The DEP says it's taking all this in. It recently completed a listening session tour around the state on environmental justice. Current Secretary Patrick McDonnell hasn't said yet whether he plans to make oil and gas an environmental justice issue. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The physical act of gardening has been shown to have a positive impact on health. One Pittsburgh organization is carrying on the tradition of Black farmers to bring gardening and holistic healing to a community they say could really use it. 90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young visited their future farm site in the Pittsburgh neighborhood of Homewood.
Gardeners and people from various nonprofits are touring green spaces in Homewood. Amid vacant and blighted properties, they've seen the personal garden of resident Amir Rashan, the gardens of Operation Better Block and Sankofa Village. Next stop, Westinghouse High School.
We installed this garden about 2 months ago. Do you guys remember any of the crops we planted then?
Yeah, strawberries.
Strawberries, carrots, lettuce.
That's Redding Jackson from the nonprofit Grow Pittsburgh, who helps students and teachers with this project.
So we planted a really nice spring garden. Got eaten completely by deer last week. They ate the whole garden.
A block down from the school on an overgrown vacant lot, there's not much for the deer to pick at, except maybe the large mulberry tree in the center. This is the future farm site of Bugs, the Black Urban Gardeners and Farmers Cooperative.
The land goes from this corner all the way to the alley and all the way over to that house right there. So you see it's a large space.
Dana Harris Yates, who's wrapped in a flowing white scarf donning a decorative headpiece, is directing the farm, which will utilize the young gardeners from Westinghouse. They'll get exercise and learn more about growing fresh food, but this space is as much about mental healing as it is about physical healing. In addition to things like yoga and meditation, Harris Yates is bringing what's called care farming to the space. Its benefits are twofold. First, the simple act of working in the soil.
Because when one is nurturing that plant, they're nurturing themselves.
But they'll also grow a variety of herbs and plants to consume for natural healing, which Harris Yates says can address a variety of conditions.
From post-traumatic stress, depression, anxiety, stress.
She says the farm's amenities can be especially beneficial in Homewood, which is predominantly African American and low income. The neighborhood often gets attention for its high crime rate.
And a lot of the children who in this community have experienced a lot of death, a lot of trauma from various reasons and different home situations that may cause them to have stress.
Despite the need for mental health care, she says many African Americans are resistant to taking prescription medications, and there are other barriers to Western health care.
If you don't have insurance, of course, that's always a lack of access. If you don't have transportation to get to different places, that's an issue. If you don't see people that look like you, and they're attempting to help you with mental health issues, but they don't look like you, that's a barrier.
Harris Yates takes a more tribal approach to care. Her methodology is rooted in her background in Western psychology, but she also practices Reiki, or energy healing, and is the medicine woman of her Native American tribe. Her business, Cultural Oasis, sells things like herbal treatments, especially to the African American members of her community.
We've never really wanted to go outside of our own community to seek mental health, and that might be a problem in some aspects. So what I decided to do was keep what made them feel comfortable. They used to go to the shamans, they used to go to the priestesses, they used to go to their pastors. That's who they went to for therapy and for counseling.
There's a history of challenges for African Americans working to take care of their community, including farmers, according to Ruckweed Bay.
This is nothing new. After slavery, a lot of our ancestors who were sharecropping, they would have their crops burned down by the Klan. So they started farmers associations.
Bay is the founder of Pittsburgh's Black Gardeners Association.
As black gardeners and farmers, we needed to come together, to work together, to share work days for sweat equity. Number two, we found it that here in Pittsburgh, a lot of us wasn't sitting at the table that was black, and we needed to fight racism, systematic racism, and institutionalized racism that exists even in urban agriculture.
Last June, her organization started a farmers market in Homewood featuring a number of regional growers. That'll expand with an indoor market in the fall, and they're adding a market in Uptown this year, too. Dana Harris Yates is excited that in addition to locally grown produce, she and her students can provide the community with medicinal herbs and plants.
Gota Kola, which helps with brain health, Brahmi, rosemary leaf, olive leaf, white willow.
Beyond the specific plants, Harris Yates says healing begins with a connection to the soil, which she wants all of Homewood to experience.
We play in dirt, and we teach children how to play in dirt, and then we teach adults how to play in dirt. It's not going to kill you. You could always wash your hands.
This October, bugs will start building hoop houses on their farm site. The raised beds and composting heat will allow them to grow herbs and produce all year round. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Virginia Alvino Young.
Virginia's story is from our Hazardous to Your Health series, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities and, of course, solutions. All of the stories are at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. People enjoy fishing on Pittsburgh's rivers, even paddleboarding. Not this guy. He's only there for the fly baseballs hit out of PNC Park.
To me, it seemed natural to most of the people that know me. They think I'm an absolute nut.
Later on the Allegheny Front, who are we to say how people should enjoy the waterfront? Life on the Three Rivers. Stay tuned. When President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, Democrats booed and Republicans cheered. Climate change has become such a partisan issue that despite pleadings from all sides, President Trump said he felt he had to make good on a promise to his Republican base. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports, there's a small but growing bipartisan movement in Congress to tackle climate change.
Climate activist Jay Butera believes in the power of polite persistence. Nearly every week for the past 10 years, he's been traveling from his home in Gladwin, Montgomery County, to Washington, D.C., trying to get Congress to act on climate.
There were times when it felt like this is not going to happen, like this is impossible. It felt like this was the most polarized issue in Congress.
Butera is a successful entrepreneur. He created and sold a company that made closet inserts and another that distributed consumer goods. But he's given all that up. And instead of courting investors, Butera now spends all his time volunteering with a group called the Citizens Climate Lobby, which works to get Democrats and Republicans to the same table to talk about solutions for climate change.
A lot of people laughed on Capitol Hill. They thought it would never happen.
But that's starting to change.
How you doing?
Good. Good to see you again.
Last week, Butera visited Don Bacon, a freshman Republican congressman from Nebraska.
I'm here every week, Congressman, and your staff has been terrific. Kyle's been so terrific in helping us out.
The Republican from Omaha is one of the newest members of Butera's brainchild, the Climate Solutions Caucus. Now, Bacon's voting record is 100% with Trump on environmental issues. But like a lot of Republican members of this new caucus, he's from a swing district, and he didn't support Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Butera and members of the Citizens Climate Lobby say they get conservatives like Bacon to join the caucus through gentle persuasion, not confrontation.
I totally understand citizens who are outraged about what's been happening. Fierce advocacy is important. But we also need civil conversations with solutions.
It took Butera 3 years and hundreds of conversations to get the first Republican on board. That was a year ago. Now the caucus is up to 42 members. Many joined since the election. By design, it's half Republican, half Democrat. And it now includes the three Republicans who represent Philadelphia suburban districts, won by Hillary Clinton. That's Congressman Pat Meehan, Ryan Costello, and freshman Brian Fitzpatrick, who all broke with Trump over the Paris Accords.
We really need to get past the antiquated way of thinking of this Hatfield versus McCoy brand of politics, where people are stuck in their old paradigms.
Fitzpatrick says it's part of his mission to make environmental protection an issue addressed by both parties and move away from divisive party politics when it comes to climate change.
I think we need to move past that and take a fresh look at things like how we grow our economy and preserve our environment at the same time.
Fitzpatrick is an independent when it comes to environmental issues and has not always voted with Trump. Another caucus member is staunch conservative Darrell Issa, who narrowly defeated his Democratic opponent in the last election. The caucus members are committed to economic solutions to climate change. Ultimately, Jay Butera and the Citizens Climate Lobby want Congress to put a fee on carbon, which would then be funneled back to households in a monthly check.
I believe in the power of capitalism to move mountains. And if we can line that up to move us in the right direction and have the profit motive drive us toward low carbon technologies, that is the force that can stop climate change.
Now, these Republicans who joined the Climate Solutions Caucus are not necessarily committing to this idea of the carbon tax. And it's unclear if Butera will have the same success recruiting Republicans who represent districts that have a clear GOP majority. But Butera is optimistic. He thinks with Republicans now controlling Washington, many realize it's up to them to do something about climate. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Beaver County is getting the region's first cracker plant along the Ohio River, perhaps one of the many that will turn natural gas into the building blocks of plastics. As towns large and small along the Ohio try to attract more industry and create jobs, many are asking, is there room for river recreation? You know, the fun stuff, like kayaking, fishing, and swimming. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board takes a look at how the region can balance seemingly opposite uses.
Business has been picking up in recent years for Tim Redinger. He owns a bait shop in Bridgewater, just north of Pittsburgh, along the Ohio River.
I want to show you something. Can you see that right there?
With a fishing rod in one hand, Redinger points from the bank to a nearby eddy in the river.
Those are baby shad. Probably not a couple months old.
You can see a few industrial sites from Redinger's fishing spot, but he says it's nothing like it used to be when he was a kid 50 years ago.
That mountainside over there was orange at night. I mean, orange from all the blast furnaces and stuff rolling. Hey, It was dump city. Back then, no one cared.
But over time, many mills closed down, and the Clean Water Act limited pollution from those that remained. Redinger remembers it was more than a decade ago when the shad started showing up.
It tells you how good the water is. Say boo to them, they fall over dead. They will not live in contaminated water, anything whatsoever. And that, look at that. They're all through here.
The decline of industry was pretty devastating to the region's economy. Redinger says, the flip side, though, more people are hanging out on the river here. And that's true in Pittsburgh, too.
Let's go, Pitt!
Don Carroll, you're 8 strokes out. Rocket Valley is 2. Mark, you're true.
This is sound from the head of the Ohio, a fall regatta in Pittsburgh. It's just one of the many recreational activities on the river these days.
We've been working to make the riverfront accessible to everyone and really exciting cultural places for the city.
Nina Chase is an urban designer with a nonprofit called Riverlife. They've overseen development of a system of parks and trails along the riverfronts in Pittsburgh, but it hasn't been cheap. Chase says the $130 million spent is worth it.
That $130 million of investment has actually triggered $4.1 billion in investment in riverfront and adjacent riverfront development projects downtown.
Now Riverlife is trying to bring Pittsburgh's recreational vision downstream to smaller communities. They recently received a grant from the Benedum Foundation, which, by the way, also funded this series of radio stories. Chase says Riverlife is trying to encourage a culture of recreation all along the Ohio River. And they aren't alone. Tom Way has been trying to lead his downstream city of Steubenville, Ohio, in this same direction. Standing by the river, Way says many towns like his are still struggling economically from the downturn in the steel and coal industries. They're trying to figure out what's next.
As the communities search for identities, there's opportunity for growth and direction in areas of outdoor recreation, art, food diversity, cultural diversity.
A few years ago, he founded the Urban Frontier Organization to promote this type of creative economic development in the Upper Ohio Valley. His goal is to reactivate forgotten or neglected assets, including the river itself. One thing he's pushing, water sports.
We're working on a project now to bring non-motorized watercraft rentals and adaptive paddling to the region.
Now, by adaptive paddling, he means kayaks, canoes, and rafts, cheap ways to get people enjoying the river. And there are other projects like this along the Ohio River. But can recreation and tourism really be an economic driver? There is not a lot of research on the economic impacts of river recreation in the Ohio Valley, but further downstream on the Mississippi River in Iowa, nature-based recreation is one of the state's largest industries. Rivergoers spend $1.5 billion a year there. But the Ohio River still has the stigma as one of the dirtiest waterways in the country. And more towns are interested in rebuilding it around industry, not recreation. Shell is building a new ethane cracker in Beaver, Pennsylvania, and two other cracker plants are being considered in the region. New spin-off industries are already gearing up. Riverlife's Nina Chase says, just as in Pittsburgh, though, there's room on the river for industry and recreation. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
You have to be creative with land use and points of access that you can have both and you can have them work well.
Back on the river in Bridgewater, PA, bait shop owner Tim Redinger is banking on it. He's only a few miles downstream from where Shell's ethane cracker is being constructed. But when he looks at the baby shad in the water, he smiles at how clean the water has become.
That's a great sign. You see that? Life is good.
With West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board, reporting for the Allegheny Front.
That story is part of our new podcast, Headwaters. Through a series of stories and interviews, we explore the Ohio River's vast water resources. It's a co-production with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or at AlleghenyFront.org/headwaters. There are some beautiful photographs of the river there, and a video about the life of a towboater, too. That's AlleghenyFront.org/headwaters. So here's another story about recreation on our rivers. It's about baseball. Stay with me here. Everybody enjoys America's pastime their own way. I like to sit on the third baseline. But Pittsburgher Pete Schell waits outside of PNC Park on the banks of the Allegheny River. Producer Lou Bluen met him there a couple of summers ago. Schell grabs fly balls beyond the outfield wall during the Pirates' pregame warmups. He's a ball hawk. That's someone who chases down balls at major league parks. I'll let him explain.
Heading down, this is the river walk. Boats tie up here, you can see the river and all that kind of stuff. This is where I come down and shag home run balls. I grew up in Chicago, and so balls coming out of Wrigley Field, that's just in your blood. And so when I saw them designing the park and saw the layout, I said, okay, I'll be there. To me, it seemed natural. To most of the people that know me, they think I'm an absolute nut. For those fans that can't see, right behind us, what is that, 20 feet, is the Allegheny River. If you back up too much, you're going to fall into the river. Don't go back. I mean, every baseball player knows that, right? First step has to be back, or is it in? I think my favorite story, and I'm sorry for giving shout-outs, good friend of mine, Pastor Guy Wasco, he was a youth pastor here at our church on the north side. I stop in the office, the guy's like, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going down the river. For what? I said, well, come on. He's a Cubs fan. He understands. So he grabs a glove and comes down with me. He talks to everybody. He's not focused on the ball because I guess pastors focus more on people than they do on baseballs. I'm a hawk. I'm looking for balls, and I see the one coming out. So I'm taking the first step. I'm racing after it. The ball bounces. As I'm reaching for the ball, and it's in my glove, I get smacked. The dude tackles me. I'm like rolling around, what just happened? And he's laughing and giggling and cackling, holding the ball. You looking for this? I still can't believe it. To this day, can't believe that the youth pastor took me down for a baseball.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to PNC Park, the best ballpark in America. Tonight,
the question is, how many baseballs have I gotten? And I really don't have a clue whatsoever. Maybe 300, 400 baseballs, something like that. I give mine away. Just a few weeks ago, up in Brighton Heights, there was a team from Urban Impact Foundation, a wonderful inner city organization here in Pittsburgh that helps kids. And so I saw they were in the fields. I ran home, loaded up a bag full of Major League Baseballs, brought it out, gave it to one of the coaches. I said, look, I got to go. Make sure every boy gets one of these. And there's extra. Give them to the coaches, too. That's what I do with the balls. Just to see the thrill on their face, it's a Major League Baseball. It's worth it. I don't have a trophy room at home for baseballs. That's ridiculous. You'd have to be crazy to collect baseballs. I collect golf balls. I probably have about 1,500 logo golf balls at home. My wife thinks I have 50, so I hope she doesn't listen to this, but I don't collect the baseballs. The dream is to catch one on a fly, and obviously I age each year. I'm 50, almost 54, and I don't know how much longer I can chase balls down out here. I would love to catch one on a fly just to see, do I still have the reactions that I can see it, catch it? Because you only have about a second and a half. You know you're on when a bird flies and you've got two steps on it, right? Yeah, it's just, for me, it's fun. There's people set up chairs and stuff now, and look, they're barbecuing over there. That just gets in my way. But to me, that's not what the river walk's for. It's for catching baseballs during batting practice.
That was Pittsburgher and ball hawk Pete Schell. His story was part of a series of audio postcards by producer Lou Bluen, telling stories about life on the Three Rivers. To listen to more, head to AlleghenyFront.org/OurThreeRivers. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Benedum Foundation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports our series, Hazardous to Your Health, examining pollution in Pittsburgh's communities. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.